In 1997, Amnesty International published this really startling conclusion about a modern democratic nation.
Right.
They reported that this nation had essentially, well, effectively legalized torture.
Which is, I mean, a massive claim to make.
Totally. But the state in question didn't actually call it torture. In their official, like their legal documents, they codified the physical and psychological breaking of human beings under this highly sanitized, incredibly bureaucratic phrase.
Yeah.
They called it moderate physical pressure.
Oh, wow. Yeah, moderate physical pressure.
Right. So today we're looking at how a system of violence gets bureaucratized, sanitized and embedded so deeply into the foundation of a state that it becomes almost, well, invisible to the official historical record.
It really is a terrifying testament to how language and like legal frameworks can just be manipulated,
Right.
to shield systemic violence from international scrutiny.
Absolutely.
Because when you change the definition of an act, I mean, you literally change how history records it.
And that brings us to the core of today's deep dive. We are unpacking a highly detailed, historically expansive, and frankly, deeply sensitive report. It's titled A Predatory State: Israeli Systemic Sexualized and Gendered Violence Against Palestinians.
Right.
And this was published by Progressive International and the Palestinian Feminist Collective. But before we get into the mechanics of this report, we really need to set some extremely clear parameters for you, the listener.
Yeah, that is absolutely essential given the kind of material we are about to cover today.
Because we are dealing with source material today that is, well, it's highly politically charged, it's historically contested, and it is graphically violent.
Extremely graphic,
We're
yeah.
talking about severe trauma, sexual assault, and institutional violence spanning decades. So, as your guides on this deep dive, we want to state explicitly and right up front that we are not taking political sides today.
Exactly. We are not explicitly endorsing the viewpoints or the political framing or even the legal conclusions of the authors.
Right. Our singular mission, and honestly, this is our promise to you listening, is to act as completely impartial guides. We are here to help you understand the arguments, the historical testimonies, the methodology, and the systemic patterns exactly as they are laid out in this specific document.
Because our goal is pure comprehension. We just want to provide the context and the analytical frameworks that are necessary for you to grasp the gravity of the claims being made in this report.
Yeah.
We're basically examining the architecture of the author's argument piece by piece so you can understand exactly how they arrive at these conclusions.
Okay, let's unpack this. The central thesis of the report, like the foundation that everything else we're going to discuss rests upon, is that sexualized and gendered violence in the context of the Israeli occupation is not an incidental byproduct of war.
Right, which is how we usually think about it, right?
Exactly. We often think of wartime violence as this tragic result of chaos, rogue soldiers, or just the fog of war. But the authors are arguing the exact opposite
Yeah.
here. They argue that this violence is a structured, systemic, and calculated tool of colonial displacement and control, and that this system dates all the way back to 1948.
And, to even begin evaluating a massive claim like that, we have to understand the specific vocabulary the report uses.
Yeah, the definitions are crucial.
They are, because the authors argue that traditional legal definitions of violence are often, well, they're just too narrow to capture the reality of a decades-long occupation.
Like how we define violence dictates whether or not we can even see it happening.
Exactly. I mean, if your definition of assault only includes a specific physical act in, say, a dark alley, you might completely miss a bureaucratic system designed to systematically strip a whole population of its bodily autonomy.
Right, so the report provides a very specific glossary. And you really need this framework, listening to this, to understand the historical timeline we were going to walk through today.
Definitely.
So let's start with the distinction the authors make between two terms that people often just use interchangeably, but they are very distinct here. And that's sexualized violence and gendered violence.
Yeah, so according to the text, sexualized violence encompasses the acts we might traditionally recognize,
Like
right?
rape and assault.
Right. Rape, sexual torture, forced nudity, and sexual blackmail. But notice the phrasing there. They use the term sexualized rather than just sexual to really demonstrate the power dynamic at play.
Oh, interesting. So it's about the intent behind the act.
Exactly. The report frames these acts not as, individual crimes of passion or just isolated sadism. They are framed as acts where sexuality is weaponized to assert ultimate power.
Got it.
It is experienced by the victims as a systemic assault against Palestinians as a collective, not just like an interpersonal crime between two people.
I see. So the act itself is sexual, but the mechanism and the ultimate goal are about structural domination.
Yeah.
Then they broaden the lens significantly to gendered violence. And this is where the text introduces concepts that honestly might be entirely new to some readers.
Oh, for sure. Because gendered violence operates as this massive umbrella in this report. It includes sexualized violence, obviously, but it goes much further.
Right.
The authors define it as basically any harmful act directed against a group based on their gender identity or societal roles for the express purpose of asserting power and control. And the report argues that this broader type of violence is absolutely instrumental to militarism and colonialism.
And one of the concepts they place under this huge umbrella is reproductive genocide. And I want to pause here for a second because that is an incredibly heavy term.
It is extremely heavy.
Yeah. And my understanding from reading the text is that they aren't necessarily just talking about physical sterilization, which is, what usually comes to mind when you hear a term like that.
Right. It's not just the biological medical definition. The report explores it as the systematic targeting of the life-giving and life-sustaining capacities of a whole community.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. If a state wants to control or displace a population, it has to disrupt that population's ability to, reproduce, raise children in safety, and maintain a contiguous family structure.
So it's about breaking the future of the community.
Precisely. This includes policies like family separation or denying medical care to pregnant women at checkpoints, or even incarcerating youth to remove them from the family unit. The authors frame all of this as a direct assault on the very intimacy and the future of the society.
There is another term in this glossary that really stands out. It's this Arabic word, esquat. And the report dedicates a significant amount of analysis to this specific tactic.
They do, yeah.
How does the text actually define esquat in the context of the occupation?
Well, the literal translation of esquat is taking down or causing to fall. But in this document, it refers to a highly calculated method of character assassination, defamation, and specifically sexualized blackmail.
The authors detail how Israeli occupation forces, or IOF, utilize invasive surveillance of a Palestinian individual's private, intimate life. The goal is to collect compromising private information, or in some cases outlined in the text, to literally fabricate and plant fake compromising material.
I want to make sure I understand the actual mechanics of this because it sounds just like psychological warfare.
It is.
The state forces find a vulnerability in someone's private life, or they just invent one out of thin air. But what happens next? Like, how is the blackmail actually executed on the ground?
So the victims are approached and they are threatened. They're told that if they do not comply with military orders, which, by the way, almost always means being coerced into becoming informants or spies against their own families and neighbors, this secret will be exposed to their community.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And in a society where honor, reputation, and social standing are absolutely paramount, this exposure would mean total social ruin. The victim's virtue and their standing in the community would be just completely destroyed.
Right.
So the report frames this not just as like basic coercion, but as a deliberate colonial strategy that manipulates the internal social stigmas of Palestinian society.
So essentially, esquat is a form of weaponized cultural jujitsu.
That's a really good way to put it.
Because the state studies the intimate patriarchal values of the society it's occupying, right? It maps out exactly what specific rumors or truths would cause the absolute most devastating social ruin for an individual, particularly a woman.
Yes.
And then it uses the profound fear of that social stigma as leverage to dismantle the community from the inside. They are literally turning the culture's own values into a weapon against it.
Exactly. What's fascinating here is that the text points out that the genius, for lack of a better word, of this tactic is that it requires very little physical force to execute.
Right. It's mostly threats.
Yeah. Yet the psychological devastation is total. And it really highlights how the violence defined in this report isn't always physical. The report links these individual, quiet acts of coercion to a broader, much louder machinery of control. For example, right alongside esquat, they introduce the concept of Domicide.
Domicide. Yeah, the text defines this as the deliberate and systematic destruction of living spaces. But, you know, reading through the report, it really seems to go way beyond just the physical bulldozing of a house.
It does. The physical destruction is really just the mechanism. The psychological objective of domicide, according to the authors, is the eradication of any feeling of stability.
Because a home is more than just a building.
Right. A home isn't just four walls. It is the center of family life, of memory, and safety. By systematically destroying these intimate places of residence, the state replaces physical and emotional stability with a state of constant, paralyzing flux.
If we look at esquat and domicide side by side, it's just a terrifying picture emerges. Because whether it's through the intimate blackmail of esquat or the physical destruction of domicide, the overarching goal described here is the total eradication of safe space.
Exactly. Yeah. There's nowhere left to hide.
Right. There's no safety in your community because you might be blackmailed. And there is absolutely no safety in your home because it might be demolished at any moment.
And the report argues this creates a pervasive environment of vulnerability, which is, you know, essential for long-term subjugation.
And reading about esquat as a historical tactic really forces you to think about the present day. Because we're looking at documents detailing practices from decades ago, relying on, like, wiretaps or physical surveillance.
Yeah, analog methods.
But imagine how modern surveillance, you know, artificial intelligence, smartphone tracking, biometric data, social media monitoring, how that amplifies tactics like esquat today. The psychological stage was set decades ago for something that must be exponentially more pervasive now with modern tech.
The text does touch on the modern implications of AI and digital surveillance, for sure. But the authors are absolutely adamant that to understand the present mechanics of this violence, like to understand how it became so normalized, we cannot just look at the technology of today. We have to trace the behavior back to its absolute origin.
Which brings us to the historical timeline of the report. The authors argue that we must go back to the very foundation of the state itself, the year 1948 and the events of the Nakba.
Yeah, so the Nakba, which translates to the catastrophe in Arabic, it refers to the mass displacement and dispossession of Palestinians during the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. And the report's thesis hinges heavily on this specific period.
Right.
It asserts that Zionist extra-state forces, meaning the militias that would later be consolidated into the official state military, intentionally used sexualized violence and the calculated threat of sexualized violence as a strategic method to expedite the displacement of Palestinians from their land.
I have to play devil's advocate here for a second, because the leap from, you know, terrible things happen in war to this was a strategic method of mass displacement is a really massive claim.
It is a huge claim.
Because war is inherently chaotic, right? How does this report differentiate between the tragic, almost inevitable crimes committed by rogue soldiers in a chaotic conflict zone and a top-down, calculated strategy?
That's the key question. And the authors build their case by looking at the archival paper trail, the institutional awareness of the military leadership, and the patterns of how the violence was publicized. They don't just rely on the existence of the assaults, they focus intensely on the bureaucratic documentation surrounding them.
And the sources they pull from to document this are deeply, deeply harrowing. They start by examining the Deir Yassin massacre, which occurred on April 9, 1948. Deir Yassin holds a massive place in Palestinian collective memory. For decades, survivors of the massacre spoke of horrific sexual violence occurring right alongside the killings.
However, for a very long time, these oral histories were completely unverified by any official state-recognized records. The primary criminal investigation file, which was compiled by the 1948 British Mandate authorities, was placed under seal.
But the report details how that seal was eventually broken.
Yeah.
In 1970, these journalists, Larry Collins and Dominique LaPierre, they actually managed to get the file unsealed.
Yeah.
And what they found inside completely corroborated the oral histories that had been dismissed for decades. The report highlights the testimony of a survivor named Safiye Atge. She gave formal testimony about enduring severe assault and witnessing the rape of other women in the village.
And crucially, the report notes that this wasn't just, you know, the word of the survivors against the military. The British investigator assigned to the case, a man named Richard Catling, he confirmed the atrocities in his official reports.
Oh, wow. So there was official contemporaneous documentation.
Exactly. He documented that, quote, many sexual atrocities were committed by the attackers. Many young schoolgirls were raped and later slaughtered.
I know. And the inclusion of Catling's file in the report is really meant to demonstrate that the violence was recognized by external official observers at the time, even if it was subsequently buried.
The report compiles multiple instances from this era to establish a pattern. They point to a 1951 publication by Mohammed Nimer Al-Khatib, which detailed a female rape victim being treated in a Nablus hospital following the Tantura massacre.
Right.
But perhaps the most chilling case documented in the report, mostly because of the sheer bureaucratic coldness of the evidence, occurred at the Niram military outpost in August 1949.
The Niram case is absolutely central to the author's argument about institutional complicity. The report cites declassified Israeli military documents, including the personal handwritten diary of Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion.
The prime minister's own diary.
Yes. The texts detail the abduction of a teenage Bedouin Palestinian girl. She was taken captive by soldiers, and Ben-Gurion's own diary entry from August 20, 1949 plainly reads, and I quote, "It was decided and carried out. They washed her, cut her hair, raped her, and killed her."
It's just, yeah. The prime minister is writing this in his diary. This isn't some secret kept in the dark by a few foot soldiers.
Yeah.
It reaches the absolute highest levels of leadership.
Yeah.
And the report even includes the actual declassified memo from the platoon commander, a man identified as Moshe. According to testimonies, Moshe literally gave his soldiers a speech on Zionism and then offered them the captive girl as either a kitchen worker or a sex slave.
And Moshe then sent a letter to his superiors detailing the events. The text of that letter, which is cited in the report, reads, "On the first night, the soldiers abused her, and the next day I saw fit to remove her from the world."
I saw fit to remove her from the world. I mean, the phrasing is what makes it so disturbing.
It's completely detached.
It's not the language of a rogue soldier acting in a frenzy of combat. It's the language of a middle manager writing a status report.
And the report uses that specific letter to highlight the bureaucratization of atrocity. The commander felt completely comfortable reporting this up the chain of command, which implies a culture where such acts were, if not explicitly ordered in writing, functionally permissible and totally unremarkable.
Right.
The authors continue to build this pattern with other declassified documents. They cite the Safsaf massacre in October 1948, where a declassified document notes the execution of 70 men and the rape of 4 teenage girls. They also cite the expulsion of Lid, where a platoon commander later admitted on the record that soldiers routinely went into prison compounds at night to assault Arab women.
But wait, this brings up a massive question.
Yeah.
If I am a nascent state committing these acts that I know violate international norms and could, you know, severely jeopardize my standing on the world stage.
Yeah.
I would do absolutely everything in my power to destroy the evidence.
Right, burn the files.
Exactly. I would burn the memos. I certainly wouldn't leave them in official archives.
Yeah.
How are the researchers of this report, or any historians for that matter, actually accessing this proof?
This is a really fascinating historical anomaly, and the report delves into it. It explains that Israel placed a 50-year seal on many of its classified military and state archives from 1948.
Okay, a 50-year seal.
Right. So when that 50-year mark finally arrived in the late 1990s and early 2000s, some of these records were automatically and perhaps very briefly unsealed by law. And historians, notably the Israeli scholar Benny Morris, recognized this window of opportunity, rushed into the archives, and began examining and copying these files.
So there was just this brief window where the state's own internal documentation was suddenly visible to the public.
Yes. And interestingly, the report notes that many of those files were quickly reclassified and sealed again by the Ministry of Defense shortly after researchers accessed them.
Oh, wow. So they tried to close the door.
They did. But the damage, historically speaking, was already done. The information was out. The report quotes Benny Morris extensively on this. After reviewing the archives, Morris concluded that officers on the ground understood that their expulsion orders functionally permitted these deeds.
Because it served a purpose.
Exactly. The violence was implicitly understood as a tool to encourage the Arab population to flee. In fact, Morris famously stated that the dozen or so explicitly documented cases of rape he found in the archives are, quote, "just the tip of the iceberg."
Let's talk about why it was used to encourage the population to flee, because the report provides a profound psychological insight here. It argues that it wasn't just the physical act of violence that achieved the goal of mass displacement. It was the narrative of the violence.
Right, the rumor mill.
Yeah. The report notes that news of the assaults at Deir Yassin and other villages reverberated incredibly fast across Palestinian towns. And Zionist militias actively capitalized on this fear. The text describes how militants would publish threats of sexual violence in leaflets dropped on villages or literally chant them over loudspeakers in Arabic.
So if we connect this to the broader argument about displacement, the threat of sexualized violence became a highly effective weaponized tool for ethnic cleansing.
Exactly. You don't necessarily have to attack a village if the village already hears what happened at Deryasin. Yeah. Families fled not just to escape bullets, but to protect their daughters and to protect the honor of their community, which we discussed earlier with Esquad.
The authors argue that this absolutely proves the violence was systemic. When a military force actively broadcasts the threat of rape over loudspeakers to clear a town, the violence has definitely moved from an incidental tragedy of war to a calculated military strategy.
So in 1948, the violence described in the report was heavily focused on driving people out. But as we move forward in the chronological timeline provided by the authors, we reach the aftermath of the 1967 war. And the nature of the violence has to shift.
It has to adapt.
Right. If the goal of 48 was expulsion, what happens when the borders expand in 67 and the state suddenly finds itself as an occupying force over millions of Palestinians who didn't leave?
Yeah.
You can't just use the 48 playbook of driving people across a border anymore.
No, the whole dynamic changes.
So the violence has to adapt from a tool of mass expulsion to a tool of daily localized management.
And that is the exact pivot the report identifies. Following the 1967 war, Israel occupied the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem, and other territories. The state now had to manage a massive captive population. So the report details how the chaotic battlefield violence of 1948 transitioned into highly institutionalized, state-managed sexual torture within prisons and interrogation centers.
The text highlights several deeply disturbing testimonies from this era to illustrate the shift. They point to the case of Mohammed Qadr Derbas. In 1970, Derbas gave formal testimony to a UN working group stating he had been castrated by Israeli forces while detained in Nablus prison.
Wow.
Yeah. And the report also cites a 1968 document from the International Committee of the Red Cross that detailed widespread torture in that same Nablus facility. The Red Cross documented the use of electrical shocks on testicles, alligator clips, and severe blows by metal rods to the genitals of prisoners.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the report is tracking a migration of violence. It is moving from the destroyed villages out in the open into the concrete interrogation rooms. It is becoming scheduled, recorded, and administered by state employees.
It's the industrialization of violence.
Yes, exactly.
It moves from a militia tactic to a bureaucratic assembly line. And to understand this assembly line, the report cites a comparative analysis by the Adamir NGO, which is a Palestinian human rights organization. What did Adamir find when they analyzed this institutional shift?
So Adamir's analysis, as cited in the text, looks beyond the immediate geography and compares the Israeli tactics of the 1960s and 70s to the British colonial use of sexual violence and castration during the Mau Mau uprising in Kenya.
Oh, wow. Drawing a parallel to British imperialism.
Exactly. The report uses this comparison to argue that colonial and occupying systems frequently share these dark playbooks. The structured use of sexual violence to subjugate a colonized population isn't a unique anomaly of this specific conflict. It is a recognizable, historically proven mechanism of imperial control. You break the individual physically to break the political resistance collectively.
But the report is careful to emphasize that this institutionalized violence wasn't only happening to men in hidden prison cells.
No, it was everywhere.
Right. It was bleeding out into the civilian population. It was happening to women in their own homes. The text includes the horrific story of Dalit El Sayed Alam.
Yeah, her testimony to a UN working group is featured really prominently in the report. In the wake of the 67 war, soldiers stormed her home while her family was just eating lunch. According to her testimony, they beat her husband, killed her 15-year-old son when he tried to intervene, and then raped her in front of her surviving family members.
It's almost too much to comprehend. But when you read that specific account in the context of the report's earlier definitions, it perfectly illustrates the concept of domicide we discussed.
The eradication of safe space.
Exactly. There is a total eradication of safe space.
Yeah.
The violence doesn't just happen in the public square or in a military prison. The state brings the violence directly into your dining room right in front of your family. It signals that there is absolutely no physical or psychological refuge anywhere in the occupied territory.
And that total erosion of safety leads directly into what the authors define as the most brutal period of documented sexual torture up until the present day, the 1970s.
The report dedicates significant space to the 1970s, focusing heavily on specific interrogation facilities, most notably the Ressam compound, also known as Al-Muscovia, in Jerusalem. How does the report characterize this specific decade?
The authors characterize the 1970s as an era of massive acceleration. the frequency, the scale, and the systematization of sexual torture against captive Palestinians, particularly women, reached a horrific peak during this time. And to illustrate the sheer brutality of this era, the report focuses on the highly publicized testimonies of two women who were arrested in 1969, Razmiya Odeh and Aisha Odeh.
We really need to walk through what the report details about their testimonies, because the authors framed these women not just as victims of this system, but as defining examples of resistance against it.
Absolutely.
Razmiya Odeh was detained for 45 days. She reported undergoing 25 days of nonstop interrogation and torture. She testified to a UN special committee that she was stripped naked, chained, beaten with metal bars, and raped with a stick.
And the report includes a deeply distressing detail about the psychological cruelty of her interrogation.
Right, about her father.
Yeah. Razmiya's father, Yusuf Odeh, was also taken captive. The interrogators brought him into the room and demanded he rape his own daughter.
God.
When he refused, he was forced to watch as the soldiers assaulted her until he eventually just lost consciousness from the trauma.
And Aisha Odeh, who was arrested around the same time, she gave similar testimony. She recounted being stripped by both male and female soldiers, severely beaten, and then physically carried out and displayed naked in front of a line of male prisoners just to maximize her humiliation.
Yeah.
But there's a specific detail in the report about the psychological tactics used during this era that I really want to dissect. The report notes that interrogators would frequently torture detainees for weeks, physically breaking them, and then they would force the detainee to look at themselves in a mirror.
The mirror tactic.
Why the mirror? What is the strategic psychological value of forcing someone to look at their own broken body?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the report spends a lot of time unpacking this exact psychological mechanism. They call it the strategy of annihilating the will.
Annihilating the will.
Yeah, because the physical pain is really only half the equation. The report argues that sexual torture targets two things simultaneously: individual integrity and collective cohesion. The trauma inflicted and the physical destruction the victim is forced to witness in that mirror, they're designed to break the individual so profoundly that they view themselves as ruined.
So they want the victim to internalize the violence.
Yes. They want it so deep that the victims are unable to ever participate in political resistance again.
Right. They want the victim to basically police their own future actions out of a sense of profound shame and brokenness.
Precisely. But it goes beyond just silencing the individual. The report argues that this tactic is also designed to deeply offend the cultural traditions and the concept of honor within the broader community. Again, it's the state trying to use the society's own patriarchal values as a weapon.
Right. Tying back to the escort concept.
Exactly. The underlying logic is brutal. If we dishonor the women, we shame the men who fail to protect them, we break the family unit, and we destroy the social fabric that allows for collective resistance.
But one of the most compelling parts of the report is how it highlights that this tactic ultimately failed to break these women in the way the state intended.
It did fail.
The authors use these testimonies to showcase immense resilience. There is a quote in the report from Razmiya Odeh. After she was released in a prisoner exchange, her sister asked her this heartbreaking question. She asked if the interrogators had dishonored her.
Yeah.
And Razmiya replied, quote, "My honor is my country, which I will never give up. It is all that we own in our lives."
It's such a profound moment in the text. The authors use Razmiya's quote to demonstrate how these women completely redefine their honor in real time. The state attempted to use patriarchy and sexual shame as a weapon, and these women effectively disarmed that weapon by shifting the definition of virtue.
Wow.
They moved it away from the physical purity of their bodies and redefined it entirely as their political steadfastness and their commitment to their country.
That is incredibly powerful. They basically refused to accept the state's terms of their own destruction. But as the report moves into the 1980s and 1990s, the landscape shifts again. Because the testimonies of people like Razmiya and Aisha, along with reports from international NGOs, they actually caught the world's attention. The international human rights movement was gaining significant traction globally around this time. The UN Convention Against Torture was adopted in 1984. Suddenly, Israel was under intense international scrutiny for these practices.
But the report argues that the state's system of violence didn't stop in the face of this scrutiny. It simply adapted.
As it always does.
Yeah. It recognized that the brazen brutality of the 70s was a diplomatic liability, so it sought legal cover. It needed a way to continue the subjugation without triggering, international sanctions.
And this brings us to a really dark bureaucratic chapter in the report.
Mm-hmm.
the legalization of what the state termed moderate physical pressure. Let's look at the mechanics of how a state actually legalizes torture.
So the report points to 1987. Following several high-profile scandals involving the deaths of Palestinian captives under interrogation, the Israeli government established a state commission known as the Landau Commission.
Okay.
And the authors break down how this commission officially authorized the General Security Service, which is the Internal Intelligence Agency, to use, quote, a moderate measure of physical pressure during interrogations.
I'm struck by the audacity of that phrasing, moderate physical pressure.
It's very sterile.
It sounds like an oxymoron designed strictly for plausible deniability on the world stage.
Yeah.
Like, how did they justify this internally? How does a modern legal system codify the breaking of human bodies as moderate pressure?
Well, to understand the justification, the report places this policy in its historical context. The late 1980s marked the beginning of the First Intifada, a massive popular Palestinian uprising. The state was facing widespread civil disobedience and resistance, and the security apparatus felt they needed legal loopholes to suppress the population quickly and brutally. So the Landau Commission provided that loophole by arguing that pressure was absolutely necessary to prevent future terrorism. It was the classic ticking time bomb scenario justification.
So they write these secret guidelines detailing exactly what moderate pressure entails, and the report cites a 1997 Amnesty International document which stated unequivocally that Israel had effectively legalized torture. These secret guidelines allowed for things like violent shaking, forcing detainees into agonizing stress positions for days, sleep deprivation, and severe psychological torment.
And the report notes the international response to this, too. The UN Committee Against Torture explicitly reviewed these practices and ruled that this moderate pressure was completely unacceptable and constituted torture under international law.
But it continued anyway.
Yet the report highlights that this practice persisted for over a decade. It was repeatedly renewed by three-month governmental decrees and even upheld by Israeli Supreme Court rulings until 1999.
Let's talk about the danger of legal euphemisms for a second, because this section of the report is a masterclass in how language sanitizes violence. When a state redefines torture as pressure, it accomplishes two massive goals.
Right.
First, it sanitizes the violence for its own domestic public. We aren't torturing people, we are just applying moderate pressure for security reasons. It sounds bureaucratic, it sounds measured and necessary. Exactly.
Yeah.
And second, it allows this systemic abuse of the colonized population to continue completely uninterrupted under the guise of the rule of law. It gives the assembly line of violence a legal compliance stamp.
And the authors argue that this era proves that the violence is not a deviation from the state's legal framework. It is embedded directly within it.
So we've walked through the chronological history as laid out in the report. We started with the violent expulsions of the 1948 Nakba, moved to the institutionalization in the interrogation rooms of 67, witnessed the peak brutality of the 70s, and examined the legal obfuscation and sanitized torture of the 80s and 90s.
It's a lot of history.
It is. But there is a massive, looming question over this entire deep dive.
Yeah, it's the question of epistemology. Basically, how do we know what we know?
Exactly. If this system is so pervasive, so systemic, and dates back so many decades, why isn't the International Criminal Court flooded with thousands of cases, complete with mountains of forensic evidence? How do you document a system that is actively trying to erase its own tracks?
The authors of the report anticipate this exact question. They dedicate a significant portion of the text to their methodology, and they rely heavily on the decolonial framework developed by a scholar named Nadera Shalhoub Kevorkian. The report argues that documenting sexualized and gendered violence in a colonial setting is profoundly difficult because the system actively constructs barriers to knowledge itself.
So what does this all mean? The report outlines five major barriers to documentation, and let's really dig into these because they explain why reports like this are so rare and why the claims are so fiercely contested. The first barrier the authors identify is intentional state erasure. We touched on this with the 50-year seal on the archives, but how does the text frame it as a daily barrier?
Well, the report argues that the occupying power fundamentally controls the flow of information. They control the physical records, the police reports, and the military logs. They have the absolute power to classify, seal, alter, or destroy evidence at will.
Right.
If a crime is committed by a soldier, the report of that crime goes to the military, and the military has a vested interest in burying it to protect the institution.
Which naturally leads to the second barrier the report identifies. the discrediting of oral histories. Because in the absence of those state archives, you only have the memories and testimonies of the survivors.
And this is exactly where the international legal system often fails the victims, according to the report. International courts and human rights bodies heavily prioritize forensic documentary evidence. They often dismiss oral history or victim testimony as unofficial, biased, or unreliable unless it is backed up by medical reports or state records.
But wait, that's a complete catch-22.
Totally.
You need forensic evidence to prove the abuse happened in an international court. But who controls the hospitals, the medical examiners, and the forensic labs in an occupied territory?
The occupier.
So the people accused of the crimes are the only ones authorized to collect and validate the evidence of those crimes.
Exactly. The report argues that demanding standard forensic evidence in a colonial context is a way of ensuring the crimes can never be officially proven.
Wow. Okay, the third barrier the report highlights brings us back to the concept of ESQUAD. The authors point to the severe danger and social stigma of disclosure for the victim.
Right, because even if a victim could bypass the lack of forensics and the sealed archives, the personal cost of speaking out is just astronomical. Disclosing sexual violence can invite direct physical retaliation from the military state.
Yeah.
And simultaneously, as we discussed with the weaponization of patriarchy earlier, it can lead to social ruin, victim blaming, and ostracization within their own community. The burden of proof is entirely on the victim. And the price of seeking justice is often the destruction of their own life.
The fourth barrier identified in the text is deeply structural. The report cites a lack of specific legal vocabulary for non-traditional assaults.
Yeah, this is a big one, because traditional international legal definitions of rape and sexual assault often require specific interpersonal physical acts by a direct perpetrator. But the report asks, how does the law categorize a heavily militarized, weaponized search? What happens when the IOF uses a medical inspection device or an aggressive pat-down at a checkpoint as an instrument of humiliation and assault?
Right. The narrow legal vocabulary really struggles to capture the gravity of systemic bureaucratic assaults. The law is basically looking for a rogue perpetrator in a dark alley, not a soldier following standard operating procedure at a border crossing.
And that leads directly into the fifth and final barrier the report identifies, the normalization of this violence.
Over decades, these practices, the invasive searches, the home raids, the threat of blackmail, the stripping of detainees, they become so embedded into the daily structure of the occupation that they cease to be viewed as distinct, extraordinary crimes by the international community.
Exactly.
They are just accepted as the normalized background noise of an intractable conflict.
And the authors argue that this normalization is the ultimate victory of the system. When the violence is invisible because it's literally everywhere, it becomes impossible to prosecute.
When I read this section of the report detailing these five barriers, I kept returning to an analogy. Documenting this history is like an astrophysicist trying to prove the existence of a black hole.
Oh, I like that.
Right. You cannot see a black hole directly. The entity itself is so massive and dense that it consumes the very light, the evidence of its own existence. It pulls everything in. Just like the state system described here consumes the evidence. Records are sealed, archives are destroyed, forensics are withheld, and victims are silenced by stigma.
That is a really striking way to conceptualize the methodological problem the authors are facing.
But an astrophysicist can prove a black hole exists, even without seeing it directly. They prove it by observing its gravitational pull. They observe the massive devastation it causes to everything in its orbit. The stars being ripped apart, the light bending around it. In the context of this report, the displacement patterns of millions of people, the oral histories passed down through generations, the documented trauma encoded in the community, the legal euphemisms for torture, those are the gravitational pull.
Yeah.
That is the proof that the black hole is there, even if the state refuses to hand you a photograph of it.
The report validates that exact perspective. To support this, they quote the scholar Susan Slamovics, who makes a really vital point regarding historical archives. She argues that a lack of archival documentation does not mean the violence didn't happen. It merely informs us about a lack of documentation.
Right.
Tells us about the power dynamics of who actually controls the pen.
So bringing this all together, the authors of A Predatory State are demanding a complete paradigm shift in how the international community views this conflict. They insist we must stop looking at these acts as isolated wartime rapes committed by a few bad apples in a stressed military.
They argue that we have to recognize them as continuous structural violence aimed at collective annihilation. The violence isn't an unfortunate byproduct of the system. The violence is the system. It is the architecture of the occupation itself.
We have covered a tremendous amount of ground today, and this has been an incredibly heavy, challenging deep dive.
It is difficult material, without question, but engaging with it critically is necessary to understand the full scope of what the specific historic report is arguing.
Let's recap the journey we've taken today. We have spent this time examining the Progressive International and Palestinian Feminist Collective Report, A Predatory State. We've traced the author's central, provocative argument that sexualized and gendered violence has been a calculated, evolving technology of the Israeli state.
Right.
We follow their documentation from the ethnic cleansing tactics of the 1948 Nakba, tracking how the threat of violence was used to clear villages. We watched as the text mapped the transition of that violence into the institutionalized assembly line torture of the 1970s interrogation rooms. And we examined how the state adapted to international pressure by creating legal obfuscations, sanitizing torture into moderate physical pressure in the 1980s and 90s.
And as we stated at the very beginning of this deep dive, our goal today was an exercise in deep comprehension. We wanted to help you, the listener, understand the mechanics of a specific historic document. By providing the context and unpacking the analytical frameworks, concepts like domicide, esquat, and the epistemological barriers to documentation, we hope we have provided the tools necessary for you to grasp the gravity and the structure of the author's findings.
Which leaves us with an immense amount to think about. As we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with a final lingering thought, a question to mull over as you go about your day. We talk about how comfortable it is to look at official state archives to understand history. We like to look at the clean architectural blueprint of treaties and laws.
Sure.
But in a world where official state archives can be sealed, sanitized, and classified at a whim by the people in power, who actually gets to decide what history is official?
It is the ultimate question of power, narrative, and memory.
If the burden of proof is always placed on the occupied, the very people actively denied access to forensic evidence, state archives, and impartial legal recourse, perhaps we need to radically rethink how we listen to collective memory. What truths are being silenced right now, today, simply because they lack the official stamp of the very institutions causing the harm?
If we only look at the building the state allows us to see, we will never see the demolition that cleared the lot.
Thank you for joining us on this challenging, complex, but vital intellectual journey. We will see you on the next deep dive.